Okay. So, welcome. I want to begin by noting two things, and they're related. One is just to acknowledge that I thought at the end of last session, we got to a tense, difficult, and potentially productive place. And I listed specifically in that order. I think there were appropriately a lot of feelings, strong feelings, including some negative and difficult feelings that came out particularly towards the end of last time that obviously have been present in the conversation for some time. But that I think, you know, I want to sort of just affirm the appropriateness of that. And I didn't want anyone leaving last time feeling like, oh, that really sort of went off the rails because people were getting angry. That's part of what I wanted this space to be, was a space where that could happen, albeit obviously with the goal of us having a conversation together. So that's one. Two, in response to that, one of the things that I think was emerging was a feeling that I certainly had before even beginning this series at all, but I think has only been underscored by the experience of doing it, which is the realization that we really do not have the kind of data, the kind of human personal data that we ought to have this conversation in its fullest form. This is where texts are at their worst, right? I mean, texts tell you about normative data and normative positions. They don't tell you about experiential data at all. So one of the things, most of you hopefully received this. If you didn't, you can speak to me after and ask about it. I sent out kind of a questionnaire that is totally anonymous, but by way of trying to draw out in a way that's hard to do with 50 to 80 people in a room, how people, you know, would articulate in their own language, not just in a responsive way, how some of this topic and some of the practices we've been talking about strikes them, how you would respond to it, how you would take an approach to this. And my hope is to begin to even integrate some of that tonight, but particularly in the last session to be able to use that as kind of a reflector back and forth for some of the things we've been talking about. So 25 people have filled it out so far, and some very interesting things in there, and I'll pivot to that in a second. But you're invited really to contribute your voice to that as part of this conversation. So among the things that came up in some of the responses on that questionnaire, in terms of some of the difficulties, I want to flag this, with the topic and the sources that we've been looking at and how they discuss it, there were many, but among them were, I just want to flag three of them. One, the whole background of Tum'ah to this topic. That is to say, a whole series of voices of people who are quite well able to wrap their head around the notion of there being some kind of abstinence within a sexual relationship. The notion even of that abstinence being pegged to or tied to menstruation, even if that's not what it's all about. But having a great deal of difficulty with the Tum'ah background behind all of it, and a lot of the pejorative elements that seem to go along with that. That's one. Two is the notion of standardization that was raised by many. The notion of why can't one approach a topic like this, or any topic for that matter, with more of a direct interface with individuals' experience, right, as opposed to trying to come up with some corporate definition of how the entire people should behave in lockstep. Why can't there be sort of basic guidelines that then are played out, everyone in their individual space? And then the third piece was the non-egalitarian nature of the practice. That is to say, it's one thing to talk about there being a period of abstinence, but why is it that then it comes out to be a system where, as basically all of the sources we've been looking at assume, the woman is going to the mikvah, not the man. It is ultimately determined by the woman's bodily processes, not the man, etc. And that being another source of frustration. So I raise all that not just to air it, which itself is worthwhile, but because I think the topic we're going to look at tonight is very relevant to thinking about what it looks like to struggle with stripping the isur, the kind of prohibitive elements of this conversation, from some of their tum'ah antecedents, and how much that happens or doesn't happen. What it means to actually think about the sexual tension and practice around nidah as something that a couple is sort of navigating as a time off from their sexual practice as opposed to one partner marking another. And the question of non-standardization. That is to say, what is the place, if any, for a given pair, a given couple, figuring out what are the appropriate lines and boundaries that keep one out of that sexual place that might not be the same for someone else. And this is also, I think, what's useful about this topic is it actually, a lot of it can potentially be mapped onto situations even other than Nida. That is to say, you can approach some of the conversation we'll have tonight through the lens of, imagine myself to be in a space where I'm trying to maintain sexual boundaries. What does that look like? How does that get actualized? What's the operational scheme for making that happen? Okay? So this is the topic known in rabbinic literature as harchakot. Right? And I should note one of the other things on the question of what do you find most difficult about a practice from Nida, which the question was either from experience or from theory, one of the top three vote-getters was the harchakot. That is to say, people feeling that, again, a certain comfort, whether intuitive level or acceptance of there being a basic boundary around sexual intercourse during the time of menstruation, taking that to a level, which we'll see shortly, that really forbids all touching, forbids passing of objects, forbids all kinds of much more minor indirect interactions, was one of the things that people gave voice to as being particularly difficult. So what we're going to try to do is get a sense of where some of that comes from, how it plays out, and I hope by the end of the night to open up some possibilities for thinking about the topic more broadly. Okay? So, I brought you Vayikra Tetvav and Vayikra Yudchet again to remind us that there are these two separate parts in the Torah that talk about this very differently. First to note that Vayikra Tetvav, which is the whole section that talks about Tum'ah, talks in great detail about touching, beds, seats, all sorts of objects that are affected by the menstruant's status as Tume'ah, and the ways in which that Tum'ah is contracted by other objects and communicated to them. And that's important for some of the sources we'll see later. A reminder that that whole notion of, yes, touching affects something, is very present in the world of Tum'ah. That's one of the main mechanisms by which Tum'ah is communicated, is through touch. Okay? And that piece is very strong there. Vayikra Yudchet I bring to you, and I brought it here in very strange form, to remind you the basic structure of that chapter, which is to go through all the forbidden relationships. And if you listen on the afternoon of Yom Kippur to a Torah reader reading this, this is actually sort of what it sounds like. Lo tegale, lo tegale, lo tegale, lo tegale, lo tegale. Don't expose, uncover, reveal, however you want to render that. It's the expression for sexual activity. Okay? And in two places, there's this interesting divergence from that pattern. So in the second line, with respect to one's aunt, ervat achi avicha, right? A man's aunt, ervat achi avicha lo tegale, el ishto lo tikrav dodatchai. Don't come close, in addition to just not uncovering nakedness, just not explicitly having sexual activity. That verb is used, lo tikrav. And then after more, lo tegale, lo tegale, lo tegale, lo tegale, lo tikach legalot. The last line in this section, yutet ve'elisha benidat tumata, lo tikrav legalot ervata. Again, coming close. Now, in the plain sense of that, it just means, it's just another word for talking about sex. The Ramban points this out. He says, in Parshat Dvarim, when the Torah is talking about a man who is betrothed to a woman and after the first wedding night discovers that she is not a virgin, his first person narrative of that is Va'ekrav eleha velo matzati la betulim. Now that doesn't mean I came close to her. That's a euphemism for we had sex. Right? So the kuf resh bet verb here almost certainly means nothing more than that. But the sifra, the midrash halacha on this verse, makes something of that verb of coming close, to make a different point. Okay, so someone want to read me the sifra achremot here the first source that's translated.
To a woman in the Nidah of Artuma, do not come close to uncover her nakedness. This only teaches me that intercourse is forbidden, and how do I know coming close is forbidden? Scripture teaches, do not come close. This only teaches me the case of the Nidah. How do I know this applies to all forbidden sexual relationships? Scripture teaches, do not come close, plural, to uncover. Those who do, what does this teach? Since it says, do not come close, could that mean that one is liable for karet, for coming close? Scripture teaches, those who do, and not those who come close.
All right, those who come close is not defined here, but what do you think it means? What do you think coming close in the Sifra means as opposed to intercourse?
Coming close to intercourse?
Okay, coming close to intercourse. So, what are we talking about here? I mean, meaning what? I'm not saying we have to detail this practice or that practice, but meaning what are we talking about here in terms of the range of things that you think is included in this? Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, I think in the Ve'im, that same root word is used to come close when they want to kill somebody, so it might actually imply touching, any form of touching in both cases.
All right, so one possibility is it actually means touching, any kind of physical contact. Okay, yeah?
One extreme could be a Bill Clinton-like anything but intercourse.
Okay, so meaning it's meaning what? It's activities that are very close to, but not actual. We're not talking about touch. We're not even necessarily talking about activities that we'll later describe as having some kind of even particular affectionate quality, but something that comes close, sort of the penultimate step, as it were. Okay? Any other thoughts on that? All right, we'll see it played out. Obviously, it could be sort of anywhere in that range, but there's some notion that it doesn't just go from, hi, how are you, to sex, right? There is a penumbra around that, and the Sifra is trying to say, don't think the Torah doesn't care about that penumbra. The Torah cares about some circle around that without getting into the definition. All right, the next text is going to actually give us a little more detail here. So someone want to give us Avot de Rabbi Natan. This is a text that we saw part of before. This is that text about the scholar who is struck down midlife because he does not follow some core understanding of what Nida is supposed to be about. I laid out my case for what I think the pshat is, but we won't revisit that now. But it begins, actually, with a section beforehand that's relevant. So on the bottom of page 1, someone want to take this one? Please.
What fence did the Torah make for itself? It says, a woman in the Nida of her Tuma do not come close. Could one be permitted to hug and kiss her at the Shir Ayin channel with her? Scripture teaches, do not come close. Could she be permitted to sleep with him while clothed on the bed? Scripture teaches, do not come close.
Okay.
It once happened that a man, he said to her, when you were menstruating, how did he behave with you during the first 3 days? She said to him, my master, God forbid, he didn't even touch me with his pinky finger. He would say to me, don't touch anything lest you put yourself in a doubtful situation. And during the later days, how did he behave? She said that, master, I ate with him, I drank with him, I slept with him in the same bed with my clothing on and his skin touched mine, but he never dreamed of anything else. He said to her, blessed is God who killed him, for it says in the Torah, you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness, as long as she is cast out by her tumah.
All right, we dealt with this text at some length, and I'm not going to revisit all the aspects of it that are very difficult, scary, traumatic, etc. Noted that we talked about that, and we could spend a lot more time talking about that. The key with this text for our purposes tonight is we start to get some delineation of what some of that penumbra might look like, right? So we start talking about chibuk, nishuk, right? So acts of physical affection that are clearly beyond touching. There is then, I translated it as idle chatter. I'm not really sure what dvarim betelim means, but it seems to be something that is relevant on the psychological plane more than on the physical plane, but not clear what it is. Then we have the notion of being sleeping with him while clothed on the bed. Now we're going to return to this later, but that already with those qualifiers is suggestive. That is to say, It seems from this phrase, right, that the normal way people slept was without clothes separately. That is to say, we're not dealing with a world here of queen-size beds where everyone is sharing a bed. The question with its modifiers seems to be, not 100% necessarily, but seems to be one in which the question is being asked because, well, could it be okay to do this sort of unusual arrangement of sleeping with clothing, but nonetheless in the problematic position of being on the bed? Or if you want, it could be the opposite way, that it was normal to be clothed, but not necessarily to be in the same bed with another person, and that's the unusual thing, or both variables are unusual. But it's something short of, right, it seems to be something short of the normal way that you would actually lead up to normal intercourse, and nonetheless, that is out of line. And then we have this story, and this is going to be one of the key difficulties for us. We have a story where we are narrated by the wife of this dead man a series of practices that she and her now deceased husband used to engage in. And then Eliyahu, right, pronounces it a great thing that this man was struck down. But it's not 100% clear how many of the practices that they were doing are normative and expected, as opposed to idiosyncratic, nor what is the exact thing that he's being struck down for. Now, I suggested to you when we read this that what he's being struck down for is an assumption that nida actually ends with the cessation of bleeding, as opposed to with a full 7-day period, and I maintain that that is the plain sense of this text. But to people later on, who already assume, have so imbibed that lesson that they can't imagine that anyone called a scholar would ever imagine that, the details in this story become critical for imagining, well, were these distancing things that they were doing, what they were supposed to be doing, not enough? Everything that she talks about, I ate with him, I drank with him, were those all violations? Or those were fine, and something else was wrong? Right? Whether you read the details of the story as idiosyncratic or paradigmatic will completely change how you figure out what this text has to say, if anything, about distances that should be created during this period when the couple is trying to avoid intercourse. The main thing I want you to see in this text at this point is there is a total blurring in Avot Rabbi Natan between the world of Tum'ah and Isur. Between the world of worrying that the wife is going to touch stuff in the house and make it tameh by virtue of her status, and clearly questions here that have to do with intimacy between the couple and are not focused on tumah. But they seem to totally run together, not surprising given that in the Torah, right, Yudchet ve'elisha benidat tumata seems to build on the language in Tetvav about tumah to construct the ban on intercourse during that period. Okay, so in this early source, it seems that, yeah, it's sort of all of a piece, right? Part of the whole approach to distancing, right? Meaning, let me put it in the most dramatic form. When it says he didn't even touch me with his pinky finger, why? Why is he not touching? Yeah?
That sounds like more of a concern about tumah than a concern about what? It sounds more like a concern of tumah than a concern of what it would lead to in terms of uncovering.
Okay, great. So that's exactly the question on the table. The thing that's motivating you to say that, it just seems like touching with a pinky finger, there's nothing erotic about that. There's nothing that actually leads to something further. I mean, that's your instinct about this. And therefore, that actually seems like it's from the world of tumah, right? Now, of course, someone could say, no, actually, it's the physical contact itself is actually the first breach towards going the entire distance. And actually, that is the wall that's being manned, the wall of Isur, as opposed to the wall of tumah. I point out that question to you to simply remind us that it's possible that it's the former and not the latter. Right? It's possible in this text that the concern about not touching is actually very much coming from the world of Vayikra Tetvav, which is worried about touching things. right? Explicitly uses the language of touch, and that's the concern in play, and that the original meaning of the story has nothing to do with touching itself being somehow sexually inappropriate. Remember, the source in the first part of Avot Rabbi Natan seem to actually suggest that. Why? Because what does it imagine as the boundary case? Hugging, kissing, and other forms of actually active, intimate contact, where it doesn't seem to say, could it be that he could touch her? The Torah says, don't come close. Right? That is to say, it seems a better read of this text, that when we're actually explicitly talking about the concern of coming close, we're having a conversation about acts that are intimate. When we're having a conversation about touching, we're actually having a conversation that has echoes or reality of tum'ah. Not that it necessarily must be that way. I'm not trying to write out the possibility of seeing touching as part of the isur, the prohibitive regime, but to remind us that it might not be. It might have a different pedigree to it. Okay? So, the next few sources here are then very illustrative for showing a trend and the resistance to that trend of trying to strip out that tum'ah piece, the sort of impurity overlay and all of its implications, from the restrictions between partners during this period. So what you have here, Talmud Bavli Ketubot 59b, is actually a Mishnah. And it's a Mishnah that lays out, in the context of Mishnah Ketubot, basically the responsibilities of a wife to her husband. Okay? We've got like a classic patriarchal household here, with wife doing certain household tasks that are assigned conventionally by society to her, and they include grinding food, baking, laundering, cooking, nursing her son, setting up the bed, and weaving. Okay? The Mishnah states those and then says, but the more help she has, the more entitled she is not to do any of these things. That is to say, effectively, her responsibility socially is to make sure these tasks get done for her husband, but not that it's important that she do them. To the point where if she has four maidservants working for her, Yoshevet beKatedra, she can live the life of leisure and sit in her chair and do nothing. Okay? It's against the backdrop for her husband. Against the backdrop of that Mishnah, that we then get the following text in Ketubot 61a. All right, so, and here the translation of this source and a couple other is thanks to Shai Secunda from his dissertation. Someone want to take Rav Yitzchak Bar Hananya?
Sure.
Please.
Rav Yitzchak Bar Hananya said that Rav Chuna said, even though they said she sits in a chair, yet she still pours and serves him the cup of wine and makes the bed for him and washes his face, hands, and feet for him. Rav Yitzchak ben Chananya said that Rav Huna said, all the tasks that a woman performs for her husband, a menstruant woman performs for her husband, except for pouring and serving the cup of wine, making the bed, and washing his face, hands, and feet.
All right, stop there for a moment. What are these three activities? What do you understand them to be? What function are they playing as indicated by these two statements, right? One says the woman who has four maidservants still does them. The other said even though a nida does everything in the house, she does not do these. What do you make of it?
They seem to be more intimate tasks that only the wife should do.
Okay, so right from the first statement, we can learn about the second statement. Right from the first statement, being unwilling to farm these out, there's something about, and I don't know that we can fully construct the social reality here, but there's something about these tasks that is kind of private for husband and wife. Perhaps the easiest one to understand here is her bathing him. Right? I think that's the easiest piece. That action seems to be intimate in a way that the others are not. To the extent that we're talking here about the cup of wine, which seems pretty clear, then the notion, to the extent that the serving is not just about the manual act of serving, but actually like creating a moment of intimacy around wine, that seems to be what's going on. And the bed, in terms of its implications and it being a place that's also used for intercourse, also seems to be something that is inappropriate for outsiders. Now that would seem to indicate the flip piece here of why a woman who is in a state of nida, it is not appropriate for her to do these actions because these are somehow calling up some matrix of intimacy that is not in place when it's inappropriate to go to a place of intercourse. But here's the piece I want you to understand that's on some level the most radical piece of Rav Huna. Right? That's the part Rav Huna says don't do. But Rav Huna says everything else she does, which includes what, according to the Mishnah? What are the things listed in the Mishnah, among other things? Cook, right? Meaning all the stuff with food. Right? Rav Huna here pretty clearly, and we'll see it in a minute, is shadowboxing with a view that what is food one of the most hyper-susceptible things to? Tuma, right? I mean, you want to go through Seder Taharot and the Mishnah and go through all the things that we're freaked out about with this pot and that pot and touching this and that. It almost always ends up in a place of food, right? So it would be a natural thing in a world where you are continuing the legacy of Vayikra Tetvav as part of the matrix of practice around Nidah that you would say, well, a woman should cook for him during that time. Shouldn't do any of those things during that time because there is some sort of residue of Tumah. Rav Huna is essentially saying in this statement, right, that's not what this is about. Right? There are people in his world who think that that is still what it's about. We'll hear from them in a minute. But that is not what this is about. The only actions we're going to focus on are ones that actually have some kind of connection to intimacy. Tumah-related stuff that you would normally worry about with respect to food, we don't have any concern about. Okay? That seems to be the essence of Rav Huna. And the rest of the sugya, which we won't go through, actually then even undermines Rav Huna from within further. So Shmuel is basically like, yeah, my wife mixes me the cup of wine, and she passes it to me with her left hand. Okay? Meaning, once I've constructed some kind of way of getting that, we're not just doing this in the normal way that might lead to some problematic end, then actually these actions themselves are not even to be fetishized. Making the bed, Rav Papa or Rava says, that's only if she makes the bed in front of him while he's in the room. That is to say, don't think that the bed here has any residue of the Torah in Tetvav when it talks about beds contracting tum'ah and things that a woman lies or sits on being problematic and that's why she has to stay away from the bed. No. We're only concerned with the psychological message being sent. Therefore, if the man is out of the room, there is no concern here. Right? Again, one of the things which we'll see in a minute is you can say, okay, but why these activities? Does this still make sense today? How does that map? We'll get to that, but right now I just want you to see what it looks like for Rav Huna to be trying to strip away the tum'ah effects of this and try to construct a regime that is mainly around isur, that is mainly just around the prohibition. Okay? Any questions or points on that before we now hear and sort of confront the other side? Yeah, Tamar.
Just confirm for a second, what are... Like, if we were only concerned about Tumah, what would be the main issues? I don't think I know enough about Tumah.
Great.
Really need two things.
So let's clarify. If we cared about Tumah, we would consider, according to Vayikra Tetvav, the bed on which a nida, or a zav, or a zava, right, sleeps, to be tameh in a way that not only is tameh itself, but anything that touches that bed then also becomes tameh. Any touching of food or anything that would be consumed in that way, food or drink, it would render it tameh. If it were truma or some kind of special food, it would be ruined and forbidden from being eaten. You know, you can't go into the mikdash. Anyone who would touch that person and that person themselves is unable to go into the mikdash. I mean, those are the main categories, right? I mean, it's all about sort of degrees of separation from that, but It renders all of those further steps tameh. Yeah.
So then when we have the tumah clearly falling away in terms of what people are caring about in these sources, is that having to do with a lack of a mikdash? Or is that having to do with, like, we don't really know what... What is that about?
In Bavel, it seems pretty clearly to have to do with the lack of a Beit HaMikdash and beginning to construct the theory that we don't have to care about these rules that are in Seder Taharot really that much anymore. Okay? That's part of what you'll see in the next source, which is an interesting source, early medieval source, that is full of comparisons between practices in Eretz Yisrael and practices in Babylonia. Okay? Why don't you just read that source for us? It's on the top of three. And the people of the east are the people in Babylonia, and the people of the land of Israel are the ones in the west. Yeah.
The people of the east say, a menstruant woman serves all the needs of the house, except for three things. She refrains from pouring and serving the cup of wine, and making the bed, and washing the face, hands, and feet. And the people of the land of Israel say, she does not touch liquid substances, and not the vessels in the house, out of necessity they permitted her to nurse her son.
All right, that's a very different picture, right? And you can now actually see what Rav Huna is going up against. There are people for whom it's very clear. The practice of Nida, right, is the practice of Nida is one in which the world of Vayikra Tedvav is alive and well, right? It doesn't mean it's alive in all its aspects, but with respect to Nida, it is. Right? I mean, this is actually very important for part of the struggle with this topic today is, why does this piece live on? Right? Why is this piece, and why don't we still have the Zav and all of that? Right? And we talked about that, and we talked about the ways that sort of affects your understanding of mikvah, and whether it's, you know, really tied into the karet penalty, or it's not, etc. But here I want you just to see sort of the dramatic piece of how much more it even could be alive than it's alive in almost every Jewish community today, to the extent it is, right? This is a whole other level of actually still practicing Vayikra Tedvav. She's not cooking. She's not doing those things in the house. Now, of course, right, this perversely, you can always sort of read this from a different kind of, you know, patriarchal power lens of, is that convenient? They came up with a way to figure out to have the woman still cook for him, which was her 1 week off. Right? And this is always the tension with some of the constructions and applications of some of the Tumah regime. And this you can see in the anthropological literature beyond just Jewish culture and practice, are the ways in which, yeah, in some cultures, what ends up happening is women sort of seize this week that they are, you know, banished, as it were, from male society to create this sort of whole alternate female subculture where they're then not responsible for doing the things for the men that they normally are, etc., etc., right? And that's the complicated thing of what's the application and how do those levers of power work. But here, right, we have a much more local dispute of, do we apply Vayikra Tetvav or not? And the next source really draws this out, and you see, it's one of these beautiful sources where you see how something actually played out in real time. Okay? It's an actual live conversation. So here it's a responsum of Rav Shrira Gaon in the 9th century that's going to paint us a picture of this. Yeah, Adina. Sefer Achilukim. It's an odd work that is sort of preserved in a lot of different places, and there's like two different scholarly editions of it that is from, no one can really nail down exactly when it's from, but let's say it's like from the 8th, 9th century. Maybe it's from Eretz Yisrael, because it does say Anshei Mizrach, so it seems like they're not in Babylonia, but maybe it's in Byzantium, some people think. Somewhere Levantish, alright? I don't know. Somewhere in there. And it's an attempt to catalog some major differences, but it's the kind of work where we have it quoted in a lot of different texts, and none of them reports the exact same version, so we have it sort of second or third generation from its original form. Okay? Alright, Rav Shrira Gaon. Adina, you want to give us Rav Shrira Gaon?
Sure.
Bottom of page 3.
So said Rav Shrira Gaon. You ask, we used to be stringent not to touch the bed or sitting places of an Edah. She would neither bake nor cook during this time until scholars recently arose and tried to change our practice, saying that we cannot be purified from other impurities such as corpses. And that these three practices forbidden by our masters were not forbidden because of Tumah, but rather because they lead to sin and our offense. Clarify your practice for us.
And now Rav Shrira Gaon answers.
Okay, know that these scholars make a solid point, though they don't fully understand it. Jews have never been forbidden to become Tameh from the beds and sitting places of Nida. Anyone can touch any Tumah without penalty. Rather, he must purify himself before entering the temple. Therefore, our practice is that an Edah performs all household tasks, except for the three that could lead to sin. Since we have no temple and cannot be purified from corpse impurity, there is no formal obligation to observe any of these added restrictions. But now there is a concern on account of the unlettered masses, lest they hear this and break down all boundaries and come to sin. And therefore it makes sense that they should have a stringent practice and make a fence for the Torah.
All right, so three really interesting things going on in this text, right? One, you see the live practice still in Babylonia, not just in Eretz Yisrael, of the anti-Rav Huna people, right? These are people who are, no, the wife is not cooking, right? She's not doing all of those things. And by the way, they probably read Rav Huna as, maybe you're allowed to, right? Nida osa, she's allowed to. She's not forbidden from it, but, you know, you could decide to forbid it, right? Or they're just off the grid of that source. But they might have even read Rav Huna as just granting permission, but not encouraging it. So the first thing is we see that practice live, right? The second thing is we see these sort of rabbinic voices, disciples of Rav Huna, coming in and actively trying to change the organic popular practice around Nida. And to actually say, no, like we don't want this whole tum'ah overlay, you're missing the point, we're trying to construct something that is different here, and therefore they level this charge of, you know, come on, you can't become tahor anyway. It's not like you can actually reach a full state of purity, we don't have the red heifer, we don't have the ashes, we don't have a way of purifying, so therefore there's no way to actually get fully in the clear, so what's the point of going halfway, right? And then this sort of fascinating piece at the end, which I don't know how to describe other than Rav Shrira Gaon confronting the fact that at least in his time, Vayikra Tetvav might be necessary for people to take Vayikra Yudchet seriously. Which is in a way an inversion of what I saw some of on the questionnaire, but also I've heard in this room, which is the notion of, well, wait a minute, once I really got rid of a notion of Tum'ah, would I really be able to maintain the notion of Isur without it? Once I really eviscerated the category of bodily flux, contributing to a whole series of practices around what I touch, what I eat, etc., would I have pulled the rug out from under Vayikra Yudchet and the ban on sex during menstruation having any internal sense? Now, in lecture one, I argued to you that I think there is still some independent place for that, and that's what Vayikra Kaf is actually doing when it doesn't use the language of Tuma to talk about this at all. But suffice it to say, Rav Shira Gaon basically looks at the social data and says, yeah, that might be right. Like, I might think that philosophically we should get rid of Tetvav, but given that I'm not willing to put Yudchet on the table, maybe, at least for the unlettered masses, right, whoever that is, we need to allow them to continue the charade of Tetvav and the world of Tum'ah mattering in order to shore up the world of Isur. I'm not quite sure what to do with that. I throw that out there less as some, I don't have some programmatic idea about that text, but just to kind of draw out the implications of you seeing this ongoing dance of what it means to try to separate those two categories, and at least one rabbi running up against the problem of feeling that there is popular difficulty with separating those two categories one from the other. Okay? Anything else on that piece before we now move into a couple case examples of what it means to revisit the category of distance and to try to think about it solely in terms of issues of sexual proximity, foreplay, etc., as opposed to a broader tumah regime? Yes?
About breastfeeding.
Yeah.
Because it was mentioned in a couple places, but it seems to me that breastfeeding is kind of like the confluence of, I mean, it's food, and so then you not touch the child. I mean, I don't even know how it would have worked practically speaking when there was a Beit HaMikdash, but if you're going to have any semblance of Tumah afterwards, it seems to me that a child who's breastfeeding.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem is the power weakens, right? Meaning, if there's a corpse, the person who touches that corpse becomes tameh. The person who touches the person who touches that corpse becomes tameh. But then the person who touches the person who touched the person who touched the corpse does not become tameh. Right? So at a certain point, the chain peters out. I think, though, that... So whether the child touching the child is then a problem... First of all, I don't know exactly what's going on there. Right? And I don't think we fully know. But one possibility is it is the actual touching of the child itself, in the sense that in an ideal world, right, in this regime of trying to minimize tum'ah, you might say in an ideal world, the menstruant never touches anyone. Right? To the extent that it's like, he didn't touch me even with his pinky finger. Right? That it's like, keep this contained. And in that sense, in an ideal world, even the baby would not be touching her. But what are you going to do? The baby's going to starve. So therefore, midoch hakitiru. So they permitted, even in their world of trying to minimize contact, this was impossible. So they had to. But they are sort of emphasizing that, yeah, it wasn't ideal. In our ideal world, there would be no physical contact during that time. Right? In Bavel, they would never dream of saying that. Part of Bavel, right? Because they are not thinking about it through that lens, or trying not to think about it. Okay? Yeah?
Just to point out that in reality, there was probably not that many times, even though they nursed the children for longer, because there's no birth control or anything, there's probably not that often that you have a mother nursing her son who's actually in Nidah.
Right.
So it's not a regular occurrence, as we might think of it now. So it's probably a rare thing, and in that instance that happens, they let happen, but it's not a
fair enough. It would be an uncommon. It would be like the first time after birth or something like that, as opposed to for a long period of time. Okay. Yes.
So we can know for a fact that Rav Shira Gaon definitely does not think that lo sikrab legalos emrasa means touching in Yud Ches, right?
Why?
Because if he did, it wouldn't be a siyag. It would actually still be halacha not to touch, even if it's just to keep you from...
Yes, but he's not talking about... They're not talking about touching there, right? They're talking about baking, cooking, etc. Maybe I'm missing your point. Which line are you... Right, meaning the conversation right. There is not actually about touching. It's about whether she can cook and do other things in the house, that if you cared about tum'ah, you would. But we're going to get to the touching thing shortly. Okay? All right, so let's go from here to a couple case examples where I want you to see a prohibition that began as very broad, and I'm going to suggest to you the breadth is in part because of its deep entanglement with a whole broader regime of tum'ah. And the second that it starts being about an assessment of what is the sexual environment, other things start to open up. Okay? So the first thing is food. All right? You have this Mishnah in Shabbat on page 4 that says a zav would not eat with a zava lest they get accustomed to a situation that could lead them to sin. Now, the presumption of this text is, right, which is the presumption of everything we've seen so far, not just, right, a nida and a zava are equivalent, whether regular or irregular flow, are equivalent in terms of there being a ban on intercourse, okay? The question, of course, is, what do you mean, why is the zav forbidden from eating with the zava? Shouldn't it be any man is forbidden from eating with the zava? Any man is forbidden from eating with a nida? I mean, why is this pair laid out here? And the Tosefta tells us, Rabbi Shimon tells us, how this Mishnah got that way. All right, so someone read me Tosefta Shabbat 1:14. John. Yeah, it's okay. For the sources, people have them online. I think they're okay. Yeah.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Elazar, come see how out of control Tahara has become. The early authorities never had to forbid a man to eat with a menstruating woman. Earlier generations decided on their own not to eat with menstruating women. Rather, they said that a zav and a zava should not eat together lest they get accustomed to a situation that could lead them to sin.
Alright, so now we learned something interesting here, which is that the backdrop to this local legislation that a zav should not eat with a zava was filling in a pretty small lacuna in a very robust practice of avoiding eating with nidot and zavot. Which is to say, forget about isur, forget about sexual concern. On the axis of tahara, on the axis of not wanting someone tamei to come anywhere near your food, there was already a well-established practice, which Rabbi Shimon describes as adhechan partza tahara, right? How out of control the culture of keeping everything tahor had become, where, yeah, no one was eating. And by the way, the implication here may well be like women who are not nidot also. Right? That is to say, no one who is in a state of tahara is eating with a nida or a zava, but having nothing to do with the sexual question just because the tahara concern is so paramount. What has to then happen? The Mishnah has to step in, because what's the danger? People will be like, oh, the zavim and zavot, throw them all in that back room where they won't mess up our food. Right? Put all those tamei people in back. But then says the Mishnah, but wait a minute, there might actually be another issue going on here where maybe if the Zav and Zava are somehow intimately sharing a meal, fine, they're not worried about getting their food tameh because they're on the same level of Tumah, but actually something inappropriate in terms of intercourse could develop as a result of that situation, right? And the assumption here I don't think is like in the middle of the meal, all right? But the assumption here is, I think two things. What? One, we'll see in a minute, something about the proximity and the architecture here, but aside from that, there is something very kind of, you know, very physical about eating in a way that brings out certain aspects of a person that are not otherwise completely front and center, that sets the stage for a certain kind of intimacy. And if not at the meal, then it potentially opens up a possibility for after. And you also have to remember that it's very possible that the lo yochal azavim azava here is assuming a kind of more formal meal that includes wine, that includes a kind of whole major social aspect that make it much more significant. That's the kind of dissection you would then do of when this does or doesn't apply. What I want you to see is, right, there's a robust practice of separation around food and eating with respect to tumah and tahara. Then there's like a little piece of it that's added on to cover this other base of not wanting something appropriate to go on. Okay? But then, of course, the question comes, so what happens if you get to a world in which the tumah thing is gone? No one's caring about that piece of it anymore. And all you were left with was managing the question of eating and sharing food just around the question of isur, around manning the sexual boundary that you are dealing with in this case. And one answer to that is what goes on in the Rosh, which is effectively a complete evisceration of the Mishnah. The Mishnah said, you can't eat with the Zava. Okay? Someone want to read me what the Rosh says here? Anyone? Yeah.
The common contemporary practice to eat with one's wife during menstruation on the table is justified because they used to each eat at small individual tables. And when his wife ate with him at that small table, it had an affectionate quality to it and was thus similar to making beds, pouring wine, and washing the body. But now, when the entire family eat at a single table, it has no affectionate quality.
Right, so note the tone of the conversation here, right? The tone completely changes, because now that it's not about who's going to touch my food, but it's about actually assessing what's the arrangement here, what does it actually lead to, you then begin to have a totally different kind of conversation of, oh, well, let's assess if this is going to lead to something. If it's not, because it's a totally different arrangement, then fine. And effectively what the Rosh is claiming here, and the history is basically correct here, right, is that the equivalent mapping of that Mishnah would be, you shouldn't eat sitting on one another's lap during a time when you're trying to avoid sexual intimacy. But sitting around a table, lined up the way we do, doesn't fall in that category. And therefore, since the Tumat Tahara piece is not important anymore, the conclusion changes. All right, so that's one example of how that plays out. Now, the sharing a bed piece, I don't want to get totally wrapped up in all the huge details here. Let's maybe do it by reading just the first paragraph on page 5. Which is going to ask the question that was already decided in Avot Rabbi Natan. Avot Rabbi Natan said, I can't share a bed. Right? The Gemara is unsure about this and asks the question. All right, so on the top of page 5, someone want to read the beginning of the Gemara here. Hannah.
Can a menstruating woman sleep with her husband if they are both clothed? The potential grounds for permission are that there are two intelligent people involved, and they are conducting themselves in a usual manner.
In an unusual manner. Okay? Meaning it's not the normal way. The Gemara is very clear. It's not the normal way for them to sleep both clothed. And therefore, we have, first of all, something being done not the normal way that signifies something is different. And the notion of two intelligent people is, in contrast to other cases the Gemara talks about, like a single person who has like meat and cheese on the same table. And can they keep those together? Can we trust them to keep them apart? Or will they potentially not keep them apart? That's a different kind of case where it's one person who might make a mistake. Right here, there's actually two people who, in theory, are working towards the same end. They'll catch each other, right? They won't sort of get into trouble. Okay.
Come and learn. The righteous man did not defile his neighbor's wife and did not come near to a nidah. This verse compares a nidah to his neighbor's wife. Just as one may not sleep in the same bed with one's neighbor's wife, even if both are clothed, so is the case when his wife is in nidah. This answers the question. This last phrase is missing.
My initials noting that. Okay? That's actually, it's a fascinating thing. This answers the question is like a later gloss that's trying to make the sugya have a clearer conclusion than if you actually read it through, it necessarily has. The sugya actually seems to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And the standard halacha conclusion that comes out of this is, yes, it's problematic to sleep in the same bed, right? But it's not 100% clear from the sugya on its own terms, all right? But the point is here, all right, so it ends with, or this piece that I quoted for you, it doesn't end, this piece that I quoted for you has this attempt to say, well, let's look at another situation where we wouldn't want it to come to intercourse, and would we permit this? If no, then we shouldn't permit that here either. Now, as much as later commentators hasten to point out, there's actually a lot of ways, though, in which we do not in any way compare a couple having separation during a period of nidah to someone and someone else's spouse. In any number of areas of halakha, right? I mean, the main one is yichud. Like, it's completely appropriate for a couple during the period of nidah to be completely alone, locked up in their house at 1 a.m, right? And just refraining from sex. We would not say that in the same way about people who are married not to one another being in that kind of same situation. It obviously doesn't, it just doesn't translate that simply, right? So, okay, it's not intended, I don't think, to be sort of a comprehensive comparison, but you get the sense that this piece is trying to take a stand on that bit. Now, remember, the bed, of course, is not just about sex. The bed is about tum'ah in the Torah. The bed is one of the main loci of tumah. And therefore, you can also understand sort of an echo of being concerned about sharing the bed as being also an echo of that world of tumah. And again, the Tashbetz here is a source that shows you what happens if you completely strip the conversation of that tumah piece and are only asking the question, what is or is not an appropriate situation to be in here? You might conclude, yes, sharing the bed, no matter what that bed looks like, is problematic, etc. But the Tashbetz says something different here. So someone want to take this piece? Nadav.
But there is a distinction to be made. It is not her private bed. The bed is alive. They are not close to one another. And it is clearly permitted because only physical, intimate contact was forbidden. But this is nothing more than seclusion. And even though seclusion is forbidden with the other forbidden sexual relation, it is permissible during nidah. Provided that she sleeps with her own bedding and he with his own bedding.
Okay, so you see the Tashbetz, again, it's a totally different kind of conversation, right? It's not bed, she's on the bed, you're on the same bed, off. Right? Which is what the earlier sources, totally understandably, in the wake of Vayikra Tedvav, say. This is, and again, I want to be totally transparent with you, right? This view is considered by the Beit Yosef, is then rejected, said, no, even if the bed is wide, it's problematic. Now, just to postscript on that for a minute without like writing the tshuva on this standing on one foot, like it's not at all obvious that the Beit Yosef's rejection of a wide bed in a world in which beds are still basically narrow extends to a world in which basically there is no such thing as a married couple that sleeps on a twin bed. Okay? That is to say, once you start to have the kind of conversation that the Tashbetz is having, you might conclude, yeah, even today, even with king-size beds, et cetera, sharing that kind of space is inappropriate, the way you would obviously say, I would hope, for the case of the person married to someone else, right? But to the extent that you're engaging the ways in which those categories don't totally collapse, and you're having a sort of fact-based assessment of what's going on here, and there's other sources I wanted to bring you, but I did not in the interest of time, that have a fascinating engagement with the question of what a couple's track record in terms of basically what does or does not get them into sexual trouble has to contribute to what those standards are. Right? That plays out basically in terms of the laws of Yichud. There are all sorts of sources that say, look, if a husband, you know, if a man, it comes up basically with a man and a woman who get married, and she enters a state of nida before they have succeeded in consummating the marriage. And so they have no history of abstinence together. Right? They only have history of not yet having had sex. And the question is, does that trigger a whole freak-out regime of, they have to be in separate rooms, there's no way they're going to have no rhythm of sort of on, off, etc.? Or does the fact that actually some time passed and the marriage was not consummated, and therefore there's sort of already some sense of, yeah, it's okay, like we know how to sort of pace this out and we have a different sense of control than other people might, affect actually the status of describing how you respond to that. If those details flew by too fast, that's fine. For those who caught it, great. But I merely just flag for you, if we were continuing this further, that's another aspect that would be brought in. Okay, but that's case two I wanted to show you of what it means to evaluate this in terms of Isur. And then you're having, I think, you know, a sort of transparent conversation of, well, what's going on here and what does or does not make sense in terms of creating that boundary. The last one is touch, okay? You may have noted by now that, well, let me ask you this. What's the source that forbids touch during a period of nida? If you have to ground it in a source from what we've seen so far. Someone says to you, I heard there's a ban on touching. Where is that from? Yeah? Okay, Avot Rabbi Natan. Avot Rabbi Natan says, he didn't touch me with his pinky finger. Right? Read normatively, meaning Eliyahu asks her, what did you do during the first 3 days? We did exactly what we were supposed to. He didn't touch me. Right? By the way, never mind, the other thing I just want to say about that, having these echoes of Tum'ah, is like lo nagabi, as opposed to lo naganu ze baze, right? Has an echo of like, he didn't touch me, I was the radioactive thing, he didn't touch me, as opposed to, you know, we didn't do such and such. But that's a way of reading it. And that's the way the Rambam reads it. And the Rambam is indeed the first source that explicitly says that there's a ban on touching. I'm not saying he's the first Jew to practice that, but he's the first legal source to lay that out. Okay? You'll see why you might not in a minute. So the Rambam says very clearly, and you see the language here of Avot Rabbi Natan. During these days, may not, right, cleave, right, yidabek, I don't know how exactly to translate that. Even if she is clothed and he is clothed, he may not come close to her nor touch her even with his pinky finger. It's the language of Avot Rabbi Natan. That's where it's taken from. Okay, so the Rambam reads the story of Avot Rabbi Natan, reads those details normatively. We did exactly what we were supposed to do. And everything that we did wrong in the other half is what we were not supposed to do. And that's where he gets into not eating together, etc., etc. Okay? But and his skin touched mine. Right, but his skin touched mine may already be a very different thing. His skin touched mine might be sleeping in the nude, which is very different from touching with the pinky finger. And then you're already starting to have a different conversation around touch, different kinds of touch, platonic touch, erotic touch, etc. Yeah?
Can you also use the language lo yikravla, or karevla, and if that's the case, it might be bringing in the language from vayikra and tefla as well. Even though we've seen how karevla can also be other things like...
But that's not in tefla. Karev is only in yudchet.
Oh,
Oh, yeah, I meant Yud-Heh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So he's probably bringing in actually the language of the Sifra there, where he's trying to sort of hook onto that Midrash Halakha as saying, yeah, the drawing near is some piece of this. And for the Rambam, he seems to include in the drawing near the touching. Okay? What kind of touch is a separate question. Yeah?
Is it impossible that the Rambam is interpreting Avodah Zarah as an issue of Tumah?
So, I don't think so, given his codification of this in Isurei Biyah. That is to say, there's another part of the Mishneh Torah where the Rambam goes on at length about all the details of Tumah, and he doesn't do that here. And that seems to imply, I think, pretty directly that he considers this to be fully and 100% relevant, even in a world that has basically abandoned the practice of Tumah. Okay? But the Rav Yah does something very different. All right, so on page 6, and he says something so obvious. I remember when I first saw this source, I was like, of course! Okay. Someone want to take the Rav Yah?
What is the Rav Yah?
The Rav Yah, sorry, I left off his thing. The Rav Yah is 12th century Germany. So he is like an exact contemporary of the Rambam, but in a hermetically sealed off world, more or less, where like they're not, I mean, it's not sealed off, but they're not in communication. They're not in conversation. The Rav Yah never quotes the Rambam. The Rambam never quotes the Rav Yah. Okay? Someone want to take this? Come on, I set it up for you as being a great source. Yes, F.
Okay. From the fact that we only forbid washing his face, hands, and legs, it seems that any other touching is permitted, since it's not sexually arousing. Even though the story in Bavli Shabbat says he did not touch me even with his pinky finger, this is only a personal solution. Minimally, it seems to be that there is no halakhic requirement to refrain from touch after the days of bleeding, and even during the days of bleeding, were it not for the fact that common practice is to do so. But it is good to maintain distance and to make events. One should not permit because people will come to him.
Amazing, right? Same dynamic as Rav Shrier Gaon in Babylonia, like 300 years earlier, you now see in the Rav Yah. A conclusion that, wait a minute, and it's such an obvious point, right? When Rav Huna says she can't wash him, so obviously she can touch him. I mean, what do you mean she can't wash him? She says she can't touch him. Right? I mean, and then, okay? I mean, it's obvious that the plain sense of Rav Huna is that they're not forbidding touch, right? Or at least all touch, or at least touch of a pinky finger on the level of Isur, right? And therefore, says the Rav Yah, pretty clear that like from this, there is no ban on touch. And that doesn't mean he doesn't have a ban on the hugging, kissing, and other things that we saw in the earlier text that are explicitly sexual in nature. But he's simply saying touch is not ipso facto sexual. That's the whole point of saying that bathing is in a different category. But then this feeling of, first of all, the report that that's not how the people were doing it, and a fear that taking that away, removing the sort of total taboo approach, will actually lead people to not be able to maintain their distance. Now, of course, the second your assessment of that changes, or the second there are more serious risks with not allowing touch, you may reassess that conversation, which we'll see before our session is over. All right. But the point is, I want you to see the Rambam versus the Rav Yah, just on an interpretive level, two totally different readings of Avot Rabbi Natan, and two totally different Piskei Halacha. In the Rambam, his answer is, the woman's answer is, we did exactly what we were supposed to do. In the Rav Yah, the answer is, we didn't do anything wrong. We were so over the top. We didn't even do stuff that was fine. Right? Those two words can mean those two different things, and the Rambam and the Rav Yah read them in those two different ways. And it produces two very different cultures of how you're then going to respond to touch, even though you see for the Rav Yah, it's more of a theoretical culture than it is actually something being practiced on the ground. Okay? All right. Anything on this piece before we get to the third part? Yeah?
Just one question about his language. He says, minimally, there's no law requirement to refrain from touch after the days of bleeding, and even during the days of bleeding, we're not the fact that common practice to do so during both those periods of time, during only one.
It's common practice. What he's describing is it's common practice not to touch at all throughout. Yes, but the Rav Yah does in another place report a fascinating practice, which is that basically after the days of bleeding would stop, they would start eating together out of the same bowl.
So there is a distinction.
There was a falling off. Yeah. There lived on in Ashkenaz an echo of Vayikra Kaf, independent of the whole Tum'ah regime, that had nothing to do with 7 days and just had to do with days of bleeding. Another place where that lived on was women would not go to shul while they bled. Not for 7 days, while they were bleeding. Right? Then there's people who come in and say they don't have to do that, that's unnecessary. But the practice that emerged was that. So it's not that they have a system of Vayikra Kaf full blown, but there's a real echo of it, and yes, that's what you're picking up in his language there. Yeah. Okay. So those are three examples of what it means to sort of intensify some of those categories when you just get to the question, right? What the Rav Yah is doing, just to sort of emphasize that, is the Rambam, I don't think what the Rambam is doing is Tum'ah, but the psak of the Rambam very much fits with an approach of Tum'ah. Don't touch, right? Don't touch. Whereas the Rav Yah is what the language starts to look like if you're saying, well, let's assess what's platonic, what's erotic, what's problematic, what's not. Yeah.
Because it says the reason they shouldn't touch is because shelo sabali de safek, which is such a weird, why not shelo yavali lidei avera, right? Safek sounds so much more like tuma.
It is. In Avot Rabbi Natan, it's 100% tuma. This is what we sort of had to gloss over in the name of time. But in the Bavli, that phrase doesn't appear.
Okay?
And so therefore, the Bavli's version of Avot Rabbi Natan can be read as a text that never entertains that Tum'ah has anything to do with this. I brought you the original, earlier version, so you see, it's coming from a world where that is totally part of what's going on. And then I'm suggesting to you, even, right, in a way I'm agreeing with your comment about the Rambam just putting a different language on it. It's not that the Rambam is poskening it for Tum'ah. He's poskening it for Isur. But he's not really creating a regime that makes 100% sense if all you were talking about was Isur. It actually seems like it has echoes of a world of Tum'ah that's being preserved, whereas the Rav Yah is talking much more like someone who's just looking at Isur. Does that make sense? Great. Okay, so, yes, please, go ahead.
Not washing the face and the wine. And are those prescriptive or descriptive? Meaning, are they just stand-ins for anything that could be considered erotic, or are they, no, these three things, and then any other personal stringencies based on what you consider to be maybe crossing a line?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're supposed to stand for something. Like most, that can then spill out into any number of other practices. Like most things like that, your interpretation is inextricable from what you think the problem is. So, meaning the more you think that there are a lot of real problems in your world, of people potentially having sex because of things that they do that lead them to that, the more you're going to read this category as expansive and look for the other things that are also similar to these categories. The more you think you live in a world where, as long as you tell people don't have sex, then they won't do that, the less you will be inclined to create such categories, and the more you'll say, maybe in very formalistic legal language, no, they only said those three things and nothing else. Right? So I think it's not, they can be much broader. I think they're probably intended to be the best three examples that he thinks from a wife's responsibilities to her husband. But remember, they're not the only thing. The zavi na zava, the eating together, is not in that list. And that's clearly also considered to be a problem. So it's not, no one would suggest it's exhaustive. The question is, how much is it, are you looking for other examples? Okay, so part three, I think, is in some ways like the most, we have to sort of tie this up in the last 15 minutes here. This is the most tricky piece, which is to say, okay, we've sort of gotten a glimpse of the ways in which Isur and Tum'ah are intertwined, and there's an initial move in the Bavli to strip the Tum'ah out. I gave you three examples of how the conversation begins to change when you start to have that kind of analysis, as opposed to just thinking about a hands-off echoes of Tum'ah kind of model. But then the question is, what is both a sensible boundary then, just thinking in the Isur world? What does that sensible boundary look like? And then also, what role does non-standardization play in this? What role is there? What kind of language is there for saying, yeah, when actually some of you use this language in the questionnaire, you or whoever filled it out, right? The sort of, a few people used formulations like, I think it should be understood that a couple doesn't have sex during this time, and they have to figure out what's the way that works for them to make sure that they sort of keep that distance. Very much a language of, I'm not sure that any source can tell me this is what the regime should be. Is there any place for that? Or, no, the whole way these things work is that you actually have to have sort of a democratic principle that applies to everyone. All right, so the first thing is this passage in Shabbat, again from that sugya, but clipped out here, which is the notion that already people are kind of making different assessments about exactly how this works. So in the wake of all the material that we saw, the Avot Rabbi Natan story, sorry, not the Avot Rabbi Natan story, the whole question about sleeping in the same bed with clothes, and the combination with the husband, the wife of another man, and all of that conversation that we saw there, and drawing some very strict boundaries, we're told that not everyone agreed with that approach. Okay? Rabbi Pedat chimes in and says, no, the Torah only forbids contact, kurva, coming close, of gilui arayot. As it says, no person should come near to kin, ligalot erva. That is to say, anything about proximity, anything about touch, anything about any kind of contact, for Rabbi Pedat, we don't approach it as, well, this is innocent, but it could lead to something that's not innocent. No, says Rabbi Pedat, you ask the question straight up, is it innocent or is it sexual? I mean, to make those dyad, okay? But is it sexual or non-sexual? Is it platonic or is it erotic? Right? Choose your adjectives. You ask that. If it is kreva, legalot erva, if it's the kind of touch, the kind of contact that leads a person to that, that's what's problematic. If it is not the kind of touch that leads to that, then it is not problematic. And then we get this really weird story about Ula, who would come home from the Beit Midrash and would kiss his sisters in one version on their bosoms and in another version on their hands. Pretty safe to say bosoms is the original version, and someone who's uncomfortable corrects it to hands and not vice versa, right? Now the point here seems to be that he, in his context, for himself, generally not clear, essentially says, but I'm telling you this is not erotic. Right? It's just not. Right? To take an example that's sort of more familiar to us, right? What is the social status of a kiss on the cheek? Is it some kind of questionable breach of distance? Or, no, it's like a completely accepted thing as much as shaking hands. Is shaking hands that way, right? And you can back up all the way. But even, right? Even you can take it to those sort of levels of affection. We're dealing here with an act of affection, clearly, but that is not erotic affection. Okay? And the question is, you know, how does that play out? And then this interesting thing of, but Ula contradicted himself because there's another tradition of Ula that says, stay as far away as you can. Right? Any contact is forbidden. All right, so the sugya there is, I think, playing out a very important conversation of, yeah, there clearly is one stance here that's saying, you can't start playing that game. You can't go down that route, right? And I mean, I know this. I've had a lot of conversations with this with people about this, with, like, you know, hugs, right? There's some people who feel very adamantly that hugs are completely platonic, totally fine, no problem, and they sort of can't stand that anyone would make an issue out of them. And then I've spoken to people who feel equally passionately No. Like, if I haven't set up some consensual relationship with you, you should not be wrapping your arms around my butt. Right? Now, both of those are actually coherent, but they're different, right? And it's sort of Ula 1 against Ula 2 here. And whether the traditions are messed up or he's self-conflicted, you can play out. But, right, I think that's actually, like, an important and reasonable conversation that the Gemara is affirming here, that it's not 100% clear what the answer is to that, and there's at least two valid approaches to dealing with that. Now, the Rambam in the next text here, just to complicate when he said touch before, where he does use this language of touching with the pinky finger, right? But then the Rambam in Yisurei Biyah, when he's talking beyond Nida, and he's just talking about all the other forbidden relationships, actually rules the language of Rabbi Pedat. He says, what's the problematic penumbra of contact with someone who's a forbidden sexual relation? Explicit sexual activity. I mean, you can see it, you can read it for yourself, and the key line at the end is, don't come near legalot erva, klomar, lo tikrivu lidvarim ha-mevi'in lidei gilui erva. Don't do things that directly lead to that. Not, don't engage in any physical contact because I'm telling you it may lead to that. It's the language, the explicit language of Rabbi Pedat here. Now, is that in contradiction with what he said to Nida? Does he have a different standard with a Nida than with another relation? Or does it indicate that, yeah, he's pulling the language of Lo Yigaba Be'etzba Ktana, but even the contact is relevant, even the contact, to the extent it's basic physical contact for the Rambam, maybe even for the Rambam, still has to be somewhat sexual in nature. Right? Is it clear that the Rambam has a problem, as do some later poskim, with a doctor taking a woman's pulse? Right? There are a lot of poskim that have a problem with that. Why? They're like the second Ula. They're basically like, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't breach that thing of touch. Okay, your life's in danger. Fine. But for something that's you know, basically a checkup, maybe that's inappropriate for him to do that with someone who's not his wife. Right? On the other hand, there's a lot of Rishonim that are like, of course the doctor takes the pulse. Right? Not so clear to me that the Rambam might not think that way also because of his language here. Right? But this question of what am I even classifying as the problematic contact then is very important and central for playing out how you would actualize this. All right, so a couple things on this, and then I want you to see the sort of key interesting turn on the question of touch, and then we'll try to bring it home. Yeah.
So going back to your point about standardization, I wonder if the Ula contradicting himself sort of sets up kind of wiggle room. That on the one hand you have him saying this sort of like very standard go around, don't go near the vineyard, but on the other hand he, in his own practice, is making his own decisions about what is erotic and what is platonic. And I wonder if maybe the Rambam here, or the other postgame who are sort of playing off of that. That on the one hand, we sort of have these standard rules, but there's a recognition that people will make their own judgment calls.
So whether the contradiction with Ula itself introduces that, which it may, we'll see at the end the Ritva who says that explicitly. Okay, who explicitly draws that out. But I agree with you, the whole dynamic of that sugya does seem to acknowledge that there might be places and constructions where there's not a one-size-fits-all rule. Okay? Yeah, okay. Please.
I'm surprised that Gemara didn't supply this answer, but maybe Ula just thinks that wine is much more tempting than women.
And okay,
so
but
a Nazir can't go into a vineyard, but a man can kiss and kiss bosoms and not be in any fear of possibly.
Right, so you're right. The sugya assumes that those are, that one would be consistent on those two points. You're right, that would be another way of resolving it. It's a good point. I don't know. I don't know if anyone responds with that. It's a good point. No, it's great. Yeah, please.
Just jumping off of that point, that there is a difference between someone you have a casual touch, between someone you have an erotic relationship with, and someone you have an inherently innocent relationship with. Not only wine and women, two different kinds of women.
Right. Right. There's two things, right, always sort of at war in this category. On the one hand, it's a mitigating factor that a husband and wife, other during a period when they are abstaining, have an intimate relationship. Because it means it's not like there's some pressure of like, if we don't actualize this here and now, we're not somehow having the relationship. There's not the same mystery of having a relationship for the first time for someone, which lowers the temperature tremendously. Right? On the other hand, there's the aggravating factor of they have a whole history. Right? And it's not just a platonic relationship of someone you meet for the first time on the street, right? So exactly right. And that's a tension that runs through the entire topic and is a fascinating tension to play out more with relationships in general, right? I mean, what does it mean to be in the space of having a boundary with someone who's been a friend for 5 years as opposed to someone you met a month ago? And there's ways in which it kind of goes in both directions, right? Okay, so great. So on page 7, I want you to see now one of the ramifications of thinking about the construction of touch, particularly that we're talking about here, but in general, sort of the boundaries that we've seen in this conversation as being something that might trade off other considerations. And in particular, it comes up with the question of someone who is sick, but I want to strongly argue for the broadening of that category. So on page 7, the Shilteh Giborim on the Mordechai reports this tradition of the Maharam Mirotenberg, another thing of the people being stringent in a way that is disapproved of by the rabbinic elite. Maharam of Rothenburg wrote, "The practice of those who do not touch their wives when they are nidot, even when they are sick, is," this is my rendition of Hasidut Shel Shtut, "foolishness masquerading as piety." I think that's a fair translation. What is the Maharam saying here? Why is it foolishness? Yeah?
Because it's like forsaking wellness for this fence, which is like, around the greater issue, which they're saying is not the big deal here. Like, if the problem is preventing people from having sex and not touching your wife while she's sick, it's unlikely to be the thing that makes you want to jump her.
Alright, so there's actually a whole bunch of things in the context of what you said, and I want to draw them out, right? One is a sort of very substantive thing of, wait a minute, the person's sick, sex is not going to be the primary thing on the table, we don't have to worry about it in that context, right? That's actually one. Then a second thing I heard you saying is, but wait a minute, aside from that even, there's another concern here, which we haven't seen this so far, right? So far, this is what's important about this source. So far, the assumption has been that it's neutral to annoying not to touch. But it's not harmful, right? It might be unnecessary, but it's not harmful not to touch. This is a case where actually there is harm being done. This person is in need of physical help. You're not providing them with that physical help. And as a result, forget about what it does or doesn't lead to. There is a harm being caused on the other side. Then a third thing that I think you cannot escape here is the Maharam Mirotenberg is German. And therefore he comes in a direct line of intellectual descent from the Rav Yah. And therefore, another backdrop in this conversation is the Maharam Mirotenberg also, I can't prove this to you, but I think, takes with a huge grain of salt the whole thing of not touching at all. He knows, like the Rav Yah said, it's basically fine, but it's what practice does. We maintain the practice, but come on. And therefore, it's one thing to have a general practice of not touching, but you're going to tell me when the first two things that we said are in play, you're still going to maintain that? That is absurdity. You've completely lost the forest for the trees. Okay? Now, obviously that's not the only read here. You read like the stay away from the vineyard, etc., etc. You may have a very different take on this. And the next two sources sort of play that out in terms of what that looks like. The Rosh is another tshuva that is explicit in the same regard, where it's not about the woman being sick, but it's about the man being sick, and the woman then being able to help him. And then the Trumat HaDeshen here, which I don't want to do inside because I want to not end too much over time. The Trumat HaDeshen then has what I think is actually like a fascinating conversation of, again, what it means to actually engage with the concerns of what is actually going to happen and develop. And he considers the question of, well, is it okay? What the opposite of the Rosh, the Maharam's case, is it in fact okay for a man to help his wife when she is sick? And he says the fact that the Rosh allows a woman to help her husband when he's sick does not prove the opposite case. Why? And here I'm speaking in shorthand, but it's basically what he's saying. Men are not trusted to basically not be sexually over-aggressive with their wives while they are ill in a way that a woman is not going to present the same problem with a sick man, because the sick man is going to basically have his sexual drive deflated, and as a result, they will not reach the same end problem. Now, say what you will about that. We can then talk about, is that accurate today, then, etc. But that's already a conversation of, what are the criteria? What are the facts on the ground? What I know about human sexuality, about the social arrangements, about some of the differences there may be between men and women in that regard, contribute to my setting up what is some kind of sensible regime. And the most, I think, amazing thing, actually, at the end here of the Trumat HaDeshen that I wanted you to see, and then make my case for the extension of the Chole category, is at the bottom of 7, where there's the second to last ellipses, where it says, and even though the Talmud indicates in one place that we are more lenient when the woman is a mourner than when the man is, the Talmud in one place deals with the case of mourners who are not supposed to be having sex during Shiva. And the question is, what kind of separation regime do they need? And there, for reasons we're not going to go into, it actually seems to be the opposite of what the Trumat HaDeshen is saying. That is to say, if the woman is in mourning, it's less important for them to have certain separations than if the man is in mourning. Okay? Take that on assumption for a minute. What does he say? Even though it says that, there is a sound distinction between the factors restraining a person from sex in the context of mourning and the factors restraining a person when their body is weak. And because he thinks the body is weak is less of an impediment in the male case than it is in the other case, that explains the difference in the law. But why do I bring this to you? I bring this to you because what the Trumat HaDeshen begins to engage there, which I think is critically important for our engagement of this topic, is the relevance of an emotional state of mind for determining what boundaries are or are not appropriate. And this, if I can just sort of put it out black on white, this, I think, is actually one of the biggest problems that people have with the Harchakot, with the whole regime of distinction. Aside from how extreme, minimal you think it should be, there's a separate question, which people often feel is not addressed at all in the sources and in the conversation, which is, what if the absence of touch actually creates emotional trauma? Not just guards the fence of not leading to sex, but actually creates emotional trauma in the relationship. Someone is upset. They're crying. They need someone to put an arm around them, and they really only want that in a platonic way. They don't want it in an erotic way, but they do really want, and one can even say, need it in that, and platonic is probably not the right word, but you get my point, right? In a non-erotic, caring way, right? What is the language for talking about that not necessarily being a breach of other boundaries that might be appropriate when one is not wanting to have sex? I think the Trumat HaDeshen sort of sensitivity to the emotional state there, and the language of holy, which here is talking about physical illness, but in lots of other places is extended to the notion of a person's state of mind of being in real distress, is the critical opening to that conversation. That is to say, to be able to talk in totally transparent terms about the ways in which individuals and couples, through their own track record, understand and begin to have a sensitivity to the ways in which they sometimes need one another, including with some physical element, in a completely non-erotic way, but nonetheless where that physical piece is important, that I would suggest to you is not at all that different from what the Maharam is talking about on the physical plane, but on the emotional plane that the Trumat HaDeshen recognizes is important. I'm not here tonight, nor do I think we're quite at the place of having the exact like language that we could write up in a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch of what that looks like. But that's what I think we need to reach for from this topic, of that kind of language of being able to make those distinctions, a la Rabbi Pedat, a la the Rambam's endorsement of him, and the language of the Trumat Hadesh and the Shilte HaGiborim. The Ritva at the end here, which I leave you to read on your own, and then I'll just take the final questions, is the best source for actually talking through what you were raising, Rachel, which is the notion that at the end of the day, with a lot of restrictions around sexual impropriety, everyone a little bit has to be their own policeman. And there's actually no way to have a one-size-fits-all with a lot of that. And people have to use this very powerful language, yakir et atzmo. A person has to really know themselves, both in terms of their weaknesses and what they're responsible for, and try to play that out. Okay, a couple final comments, and we'll end with that. Tamar, Josh, and tell me your name, because I didn't get it. Batya. Okay, yes.
I've been following this whole discussion about trying to reduce the amount of romantic or erotic things or kind of surrounding touch, but I actually think even that can be construed as too far. Like, what we're actually seeing in Chumash is not about erotic, it's about sex, like a certain act. And it seems to me that there should be some conversation of like, okay, seriously, everything but sex is on the table. That's fine. If there's not sexual intercourse as defined by Bill Clinton, then like it's not, there's not a problem. And I think that like there's this insistence on kind of like removing the erotic from midah, which I don't think is really necessary. It's like, I mean, the Tumah stuff, I don't even fully feel like I understand for myself, but like, if we're not going to this place of like, there's some spiritual need that we're going to do a kind of extended leave of each other, and it's really just like, basically a physical component, like there is a substance that we don't want to be in contact with, there's really no problem that people should be sleeping naked in a bed together or in a bed together with underwear on. Or, I mean, like, infinite possibilities.
Great. So two things quickly on that. One, I didn't get into it here, but a whole other staple of this conversation is the Rambam versus the Ramban of what is biblically included in the penumbra. I gave you the Sifra as if it's so simple to say that that is included in the biblical penumbra. And the Ramban says, that Sifra is an asmachta, it's a rabbinic fence, but that the Torah doesn't ultimately care about. He still thinks, he still cares about it, but he would say a version of what you're saying, and no, the Torah is only concerned with, as you say, one thing and one thing alone, and then everything else is outside of it. Now, the other question I think you'd have to answer is it, you'd have to answer, you are presuming, right, in your question that you can say, avoid this act, and it's in fact plausible to do everything up to that act without doing that act, which most of these sources do not assume. But to the extent that you actually wanted to say, we have a sexual culture today that has a bright line around that, which I'm not sure, I have to think about that, has a bright line around that in a way that an earlier period did not, then that's potentially relevant. Right?
I mean, I think that like the culture that we do have around consent and also around safe sex actually has kind of fostered a culture of like, essentially of there are many situations in which we'll do everything but, and so that is not something that seems like so weird to ask of people or something that people will be unfamiliar with.
Okay. Yes, Josh.
It seems to me that, you know, if one were to take this all the way through and one were totally abstaining from touch during Midah, that in a community in which Shmirat Nigiyah is not the norm, then actually you're in a situation where the person you're closest to is the person you can't touch, whereas other people you can. And that seems to me like a situation that can't, like, hold.
That we're kind of, there's the context that you're situated in also is like an important factor.
All right, so that's where also the question that was raised in the back of the sort of the double-edged sword of what it means to be familiar with someone becomes really very relevant. Because the sense, of course, in which it does hold is, to the extent that that is the person that you have an intimate sexual relationship with, that may be the thing that you're most in danger of sort of getting off of the place that you want to be on. And that's the sense in which it's coherent. But where you're 100% right is obviously to the extent that there's any category of something that's not erotic, and you posit that, right, that there is some such threshold, then of course the outside world and the way you're willing to behave with someone else who you don't have that licensed relationship with is for sure relevant. Yes, Patya, we'll give you the last comment.
Okay. I thought you were going to make the exact opposite conclusion from the Trumanadeshan, because he specifically is separating physical discomfort and emotional trauma by saying we don't learn from the mourner to the sick person.
They're different. My point was not to say they're the same at all. They're different, but they are both relevant. And actually, what's striking about what he says is, in one case, the emotional issue is a more powerful barrier than the physical one. Meaning he's willing to say that, no, but not in terms of restriction. It's a more powerful intuitive barrier. Essentially what he says is, listen, a man would have sex with his wife while she's sick, and he wouldn't do it when her father had just passed away. And that's because the repulsion from the emotional state of the impropriety of sex is more powerful to him, that's his claim here, than his repulsion from her physical weakness. And therefore, the Gemara does not set up as many safeguards around a man and his wife while she's a mourner, as it does around, he claims, around a man and her wife while she's a nidah but sick. So that's what I'm plugging into, is that the notion that the emotional piece there, the Trumata Deshan, opens up for us, the emotional piece being enough of a barrier that therefore, just to maybe I'm not being clear, that therefore one could imagine a space where you're saying, when your partner is upset and crying, or you know that if you don't comfort them from past experience, that's what's going to end up happening, okay, right? If I'm not at risk, because of the mood that is there, I'm not necessarily at risk of crossing that sexual threshold.
But why isn't he saying exactly the opposite? Namely that even when her father just passed away, we allow him to be alone in the same room because we know he's not going to touch her and he's not going to have sex with her. But it's the opposite. They're not saying we can allow them to be alone because we're going to allow him to hug her. He's saying the exact opposite. Despite the fact that she's in the utmost emotional distress, we know we can leave them alone because there's no chance he's going to touch them. He's going to touch her.
Because I'm not sure touch is a relevant axis. I think it's he's not going to be erotic with her. Right? Meaning touch is not in the Gemara there, and as you saw from the Rav Yah, touch is not explicitly anywhere. The question is, you could say it's more like, will he end up bathing her? Right? Or the other things that we've sort of seen here that go in that route. And that's what it seems to me the conversation about Yichud and not worrying about it is we're not worried this is going to go to an improper place. As I said, the tshuva to say that takes a lot more work and a lot more of closing places. But I think the Trumata Deshan would be an important piece for someone who would say, no, they only said the physical boundary, physical limitations and concerns create those kinds of boundaries, not emotional ones. That's where I think the Trumata Deshan is important.
And is her sexual agency ever a question of the woman being the one to break the boundaries under sickness or duress?
Well, in a lot of sources, that distinction isn't made, and therefore it is sort of implicitly presumed that they both takes two to tango, right? The Trumata Deshan happens to be a source that says, wait a minute, this actually breaks down unevenly, right? But that would be interesting. It's always hard to judge from silence how many of these sources are, assuming that, how many have not engaged in a meaningful way. Okay, we'll end here. Thanks for staying a little later. Next time, the last session.